Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spartan Life Radio, brought to you by Norfolk State University, home of the mighty Spartans. Spartan Life Radio was created with you in mind. It's your source for news and information about NSU matters, including students, faculty, staff, administrators, alumni, and the communities we serve.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this edition of Spartan Life Radio, coming to you live from Norfolk State University. According to the NBC News First Read, its politics website, the 2016 presidential campaign will go down in American history as one of the worst political contests, and that's stating it mildly. Quoting from the First Read, the state of politics, and especially discourse in this 2016 presidential race, has hit rock bottom when a Supreme Court justice is trading insults with the Republican Party's presumptive presidential nominee. It all started when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg told the New York Times, quote, "I can't imagine what the country would be like with Donald Trump as our president." She then doubled down in a later interview. "He is a faker. He says whatever comes into his head at the moment. How has he gotten away with not turning over his tax returns?" End quote. Donald Trump then tweeted out, and I quote, Justice Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court has embarrassed us all by making very dumb political statements about me. Her mind is shot. Resign. End quote. Hello, everyone. I'm Sharon Hoggart, host of Spartan Life Radio, and today we're going to dig past all of this contentious rhetoric and get down to the nitty-gritty of this campaign. We're going to give our listeners the 411 on the real issues. Joining us today are two of the country's foremost political experts, each having conducted extensive research into the political process, government, the courts, and international law. These power hitters have also provided political analysis for numerous publications and news magazine shows around the country. Dr. Barnes and Professor Carol Pretlow, welcome to Spartan Life Radio.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, let's jump right into it. Listeners, if you've got a question about today's topic or you just want to have a comment about the 2016 presidential election, call us at 1-347-850-8515. That number again, 1-347-850-8515. Simply follow the prompts to speak to our guests. As we mentioned at the top of the show, every newscaster from here to Timbuktu has commented on the 2016 presidential election. It's newsworthy, no doubt, but with all the news coverage, political advertising, and bickering, many voters may feel they are missing something in all the debate. In one of Trump's political ads, he says, I know more about ISIS than the generals know, believe me. Now, I don't know about my experts today and about you guys in Blog Talk Radio land, but to me that was a scary statement. So let's get our guests to weigh in. Got a question about the topic? Call us at 1-347-850-8515. Professor Pretlow, you have a background in mass communication. How much can we believe some of the stuff that we see in these political advertisings? Is analyzing the ads a good method to pick a candidate?
Well, I would take it with a grain of salt, frankly, because political ads are designed for the candidate to appeal and attract voters. And so they're going to put their spin on things to make themselves look good and not necessarily to deal with all the facts in the situation and laws related to those facts and the organizational process by which these solutions are crafted. And so they are designed actually to present an image. I don't give them too much weight.
So it's just designed to present an image.
Yeah. You know, if you look at Hillary Clinton's ads, they're all designed. One particularly has children looking at varying statements of Trump. And, of course, the tagline at the end is, we are, it's something to the effect that we have to be careful what our images are because we're leaving a legacy for our children. But, of course, these all are designed to make Donald Trump look good, look bad, and Hillary look Good. Now, the reverse is true with, well, the one or two ads that I've seen for Trump are very minimal because his budget for advertising is very limited. But it's the same thing.
That's kind of scary, too, because, again, if you're just writing advertising and presenting advertising to conjure up an image or present an image that you want, that means that you're not discussing the issues, correct?
Well, kind of. Initially, when ads were first designed, or when you think about advertising, particularly back in the 50s, there was very little, there wasn't any round-the-clock news. And so you'd see news in the morning, news at noon, and in the evening and at 11 o'clock at night. But now we have a 24/7 news cycle. So I'm trying to figure out, why do we need those ads? Because you'd have to be very isolated not to know who's running, what the issues are, what the problems are, because it's out there. You know, people text it, they do emails, they do webcasts.
Social
you know,
media.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so
okay,
it's
I like
a whole different ballgame.
Okay. I'd like you both to comment on this next question. In battleground states, Team Clinton spent more money in advertising than Team Trump. The breakdown, Democrats spent $57 million versus $3.6 million spent by the Republicans. What's going on here? Why the big spending gap in the battleground states? Dr. Barnes, will you start off?
Well, the answer to that is very simple. The Democrats have raised more money than the Republicans at this point in time. For those persons who are viewing the Republican convention, they've noticed that reference has been made to bring in the deep-pocket donors to give to the Trump campaign. So right now, he doesn't have a lot of money to spend. And the Democrats do, so they are taking advantage of that. Now, that's not to say that after the Republican convention and the Republicans come out as united as they possibly can be at this point, that their big deep-pocket donors will start giving. But right now, guys such as Edelson and the Koch brothers and what have you, they have not given to the extent that would allow the Republican Party and their nominee, Mr. Trump, to run a lot of campaigns because campaign ads are expensive to run.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I'm sorry, what'd you say?
The Republicans just don't have the money at this point.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That is true. And that might be one of, when you look at Trump's strategies and how he gets attention from the media, he does it by making outrageous comments and things that the media is naturally going to follow up on. So he's getting a lot of free publicity as well. And maybe he does that because he doesn't have the money to spend with the more polished presentations.
Well, he certainly has been a master at getting free publicity, but now he has to shift to the general election rather than the primary election, and the general election is a different creature. So he's going to have to change his media plan schedule to reach those so-called battleground states and to solidify his base in states that he feels pretty confident that the Republicans will carry.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
Go ahead, Professor Pretler, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that after viewing the convention this week, I think he's going to have his work cut out for him. It'll be interesting tonight to see his presentation. This week has been kind of disappointing to me in terms of them presenting professional images and being serious about the issues, because all of these side debates and these side statements about each other, I just could do, I could use little of that, and I think the public too.
Well, if I may comment on that, what you have not seen at the Republican convention this past few days is a lot of information on the issues. And as you move into the general election, people want to hear, okay, I'm going to do something about immigration, for instance. But now they want to know, well, what is it specifically you're going to do to solve this immigration problem? They want to know that you're going to bring jobs back to America. But in the general election, they want you to tell them how.
Yeah, that's true. It interests me this morning to hear Trump's statement about NATO and United States walking away from it. But he makes these statements, but the reality is we have a treaty that engages us in NATO, and you have to know what we signed on to and how you get out of this specific agreement. And he doesn't talk about these things. He just makes these bold statements without too much delving into how and to what extent and how much is it going to cost and what are the other responses going to be. So,
doesn't the presidential candidate know that we have an agreement with NATO, that we just can't not be in it anymore? Shouldn't he know that in the history behind that?
Well, Ms. Hoggett, I think what he said in essence was that our NATO allies cannot assume that they will have the automatic support of the United States. It was sort of like he was saying, well, we're going to look at this issue by issue and decide what we're going to weigh in on and what we are not going to weigh in on. But I think we need to remember about the Trump campaign is that he has not given a lot of substance, and he has not acknowledged how politics actually works in the United States and globally. And that is, sure, you're president of the United States, but your power is not unilateral. There is a legislative branch. There is a judicial branch. And even within the executive branch, you have all of these components that you have to bring together. And even in the best administration, the most well-run administration, some of these components in the executive branch can be on different sheets. They can have different scripts. They can conflict. They can disagree. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Trump has campaigned as if his power is unilateral in the United States, and then that power would be extended in a unilateral way in the world. The world isn't like that.
Lovely. Let me ask you this, Dr. Barnes. Why is it such a no-no for Justice Ginsburg to comment on Donald Trump's campaign? Doesn't she have the same right of freedom of speech as the rest of us?
Yes, of course she has freedom of speech, but by virtue of her position and the place of that position in American politics, the court systems are supposed to be the final arbiters of what is lawful and what is not lawful. So you expect those individuals to have an air of neutrality, even though we know they're human beings, they have opinions, they are appointed by partisan individuals. We don't expect them to vocalize their partisan views. Now, is she the first one to have done that? Absolutely not. But in modern times, perhaps she has been closest to the line of, don't cross that line, than any other justice in recent times. So, yes, mm-hmm. she has freedom of speech, but by virtue of her position, because we expect the law to, and the Constitution of the United States to be viewed in an objective manner, perhaps she should not have been so vocal. I thought she crossed the line.
Well,
Professor Pretlow, and he didn't when he said her mind was gone, she should resign.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said, you said she kind of crossed the line, and I'm saying he didn't when he tweeted out there telling her mind was gone, she should retire. She should resign, I mean.
Well, I don't think her mind is gone. She
but that's
is
what
very.
Said.
Yeah, Mr. Trump. But Mr. Trump says so many things that one is amused by or horrified by. There is an expectation that justices will have complete objectivity when they mm-hmm. decide cases, and when they voice their personal opinions to that extent, then people begin to question the objectivity of the decisions they make.
Understood. Professor Pretlow, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, because I agree with Dr. Barnes to that, but I also think that she has a trump card, excuse the pun, and that is, so what? What's going to happen to her? They have lifetime appointments, and nobody can make her step down. It's like Thurgood Marshall. I'm not talking about similar circumstance, but about a year before he passed, people were in Washington asking, why didn't he step down? Why didn't he step down? And then he got sick and was in the hospital. He's going to step down. No, he didn't do that. And I think one thing that gives them so much power is that they are feeling a freedom to express their power and authority is they know that they are a lifetime appointment. So, you know, there you are.
But Professor Pretlow, what happens, though, is suppose we have another Bush-Gore situation. There would be numerous calls for her to recuse herself, I'm sorry, from that decision because she has already taken a stance on it.
Oh, think, yeah, I understand.
You would think that when cases go to the court, they have not taken a stance on it. They listen to the evidence and what have you, and then they make a decision. Of course, you are absolutely correct. She does not have to step down. But I just thought in this instance she went a bit too far.
I think she did. But on the other hand, my expectation of total objectivity is not quite there. You know, I spent some time studying the opinions of Scalia, and I was like, okay, let's look at his background. And I was fortunate he came to my constitutional law class to lecture. And I have to give him this. He was not adversarial to the class when he was explaining his perspective, but perspectives are developed from a context, and his context was, and his experiences were very conservative-based experiences. So I guess my feeling is that objectivity is a goal, but it's rarely achieved.
Oh, I certainly agree with that. No one is 100% objective. But when we look at our judiciary, we would hope and pray that they will be as objective as humanly possible.
Agreed.
I agree,
too. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this Donald Trump's campaign theme. I thought this was kind of interesting. Let's make America great again. Is it just a tagline? What do you think it really means?
Mr. Trump has come up with so many taglines. His first one was, let's make America great again. But if you notice the tagline that was that is playing out at the convention is, let's make America safe. It is a tagline, but politicians have to do that because, first of all, when you're campaigning, you have to talk in sound bites. Mm-hmm. And you have to get something that your listeners will latch on to. So you can't say anything too long and complicated. You got to get their attention first. And you get their attention by coming up with these catchy, smart, short taglines. So, yes, it is a tagline. And you'll see several.
No other meaning behind that.
And Sharon, I know where you're going with that.
And when I heard that, let's make America great again, I said to myself, where is he trying to take us back? Or back does he want to go? When was America great in his opinion? Was it great when we had slavery? Far back, but if you were to ask him, I think he would say, no, that's not what I mean. He would probably, and I certainly am not trying to speak to him, but he would certainly, I think, not suggest that he would go where I went when I heard, let's make America great again. Because when I heard that, I was thinking, not only from an ethnic perspective, but from a gender perspective. I was thinking, is he saying that women need to be put in their place?
Professor Petler, what do you think about that tagline?
Well, I agree with Dr. Barnes. That's where my mind was going. Now, on the other hand, it's so funny because yesterday I was having a conversation with someone that told me that he was speaking economically, and he was thinking that there was a time maybe in the late 60s, early 70s when our economy was stable, we were beginning to globalize and things were, everything was wonderful. And I said, well, why doesn't he just say that then? Why does he leave it? And this person said, yeah, because if he leaves it vague, then you can jump to any conclusion you want to, and then you can kind of follow that. And I was like, okay, I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting.
Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, you've got a question for the guest, or you just want to jump in, call us at area code 347-850-8515. Press 1 on your telephone keypad if you want to talk to our guest. Professors, how has the racial divide in the U.S. impacted partisanship, and if so, how?
That's a good question.
In America today, we are at a point where ethnic divides are more sharper than ever. There's a lot of tension, and with tension, you get a fair amount of turmoil, and it pits neighbors against neighbors, communities against communities, religious groups against religious groups, and it is just not good, in my opinion. But I do think that we have a heightened racial divide in America today that we probably have not seen since the civil rights struggle when I was growing up in the 60s and the 70s.
Wow. Professor Petlow?
Yeah, I think we do. And it's strange. I went to a meeting yesterday accidentally with Black Lives Matter and members of the City Council in Norfolk. And one thing that stood out to me is that we were talking about issues very calmly and very analytically, very objectively. And I said, well, and my mind went back to when I was a child. That kind of conversation would not have happened across racial lines. So there has been some progress. But on the other hand, by the time I got to college, I was a part of the Black Power movement, you know, power to the people and all of that. So I almost feel like we go around in circles. We think things are resolved. We resolve some issues, but here we are again debating some of these same issues. And that's trouble.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go back to the Republican National Convention. We talked about it a little earlier. Anything stand out in particular to you guys? Anything? I mean, there's been a ton of memes on social media, but I don't want to goad you into talking about one or the other. Anything stand out for you?
Well,
go ahead, Professor Petlow, go ahead.
Well, what stood out to me and what I've spent 2 days doing research on is plagiarism. And I went back to one of my courses on copyright law and plagiarism. And then, fortunately, the New York Times yesterday did a whole article, and they did a dividing line on the comments that was made by Mrs. Trump and the ones made by Mrs. Obama. And definitely it fit the legal definition of plagiarism. Now, how that's interpreted and applied is a whole long list of here is what we do in this circumstance and here's what we do in another circumstance. So there's wiggle room there. The thing that really concerned me, though, is that I could see how someone could make an innocent mistake, maybe. But when it's so closely aligned in wording, I'm like, how did you not know? Or how did your speech writers not know? And by the way, you could do something that I do with my student papers. I put them through the system and put in the little key numbers and the key site, and it'll say, ooh, this is where this came from, this is where that came from. So that stood out to me.
Well, the plagiarism thing was not the thing that stood out mostly to me. One of the things that stood out mostly to me was the continued divisiveness that the Republicans brought to the convention. One of the more interesting things was Senator Cruz's speech last evening. And the receptiveness of the audience to that speech. And then to top that off, Mrs. Cruz had to be led out of the convention site for her own safety. And it just played up that at the point that the Republicans really haven't gotten it all together in terms of unifying the party. Now, Senator Cruz's speech was just one thing. Another thing that really caught my attention was the actions of a fellow Virginian, Mr. Cuccinelli, when he tore off his credentials because he was upset about the way the party leadership handled the protest against having Mr. Trump as the nominee. So I was just watching and saying, well, they really still have quite a way to go in order to get this unity thing together. And then another aspect that I found really captivating was the role that the children of the, at that time, presumptive nominee played in the convention. I don't recall in my lifetime the offspring of a nominee having such front and center roles as Mr. Trump's children.
Well, you know, that's a good point, too, because I thought the same thing, and I was like, is he just filling in the gaps here? Because look at the list of people who said they wouldn't be there. You know, the Bushes weren't there. Romney wasn't there. And many of the people who had contributed to the party in the past, even some of the financial contributors. And I started Googling and seeing if I could make a list of them. I haven't finished yet. Have said no. So I'm like, okay, so he says he's a non-traditionalist. Maybe this is his way of proving how non-traditional he is.
And except for Mr. Trump's children, the speakers generally have not spoken mostly about how good Mr. Trump is. Have they spoken mostly about how bad Secretary Clinton is?
Yeah.
You wonder, were they struggling to find things to say about Mr. Trump that were favorable, and they sort of fell short on that, so they hedged their speeches on just focusing on Secretary Clinton.
Okay.
Could be.
All right. Controversy has kind of plagued this this election campaign, both candidates. It's evident, it's just ever present everywhere you look. I mean, Trump University was embroiled in a legal battle. His violence has been erupted at several of his political rallies, and then there was the plagiarism thing, and there are some reports have come out about his wife having lied about her, getting a degree. Have these things impacted the campaign, and if so, how? Dr. Barnes?
Well, I think they will have some impact, because even though candidates will declare that they will not run a negative campaign, we have found that negative campaigns work. So I don't think that the negativity is going to go away. So they are going to talk about the speech of Mrs. Trump. They are going to talk about her education credentials. They may even talk about her immigrant status, that she's an American citizen. But all of those things will be brought in, particularly when Mr. Trump starts talking about his immigration policy and who should come and who should not. I think you're going to hear repeated the comment made by Mr. Trump's first wife, Ivana, when she said that, sure, we need, I don't want to try to paraphrase them, but she said something that we need immigration. After all, who's going to clean our houses and do something else? And so you're going to see those things in campaign ads, and it's going to be up to each campaign to try to lower their negatives and raise their positives. For Clinton, it's going to be
Benghazi.
Benghazi. It's going to be the emails.
The emails.
Bill Clinton is a negative and a positive. It's going to be Obama, a negative and a positive. So I think you're going to see a great deal of negativity in this campaign.
Professor Pretlow?
Well, you know, I was thinking, and I agree, but I'm trying to wonder when there was ever a campaign that there wasn't negativity. You know, now maybe because we have, again, a 24-hour news cycle, there are more avenues for getting information out there. I mean, we are maybe more aware of it, but campaigning has always been rough.
Yeah, it's a rough and tumble world, but have you
but has
had,
it ever been this bad? Has it ever been this bad?
Candidates so openly call names. during the primary elections, particularly on the Republican side, because they had to weed out all of those candidates. They had 17. But Mr. Trump had a nickname for all of them, for each one of them.
Yeah, so it could be said that he is heightening the negativity.
Well, Professor Pretlow, I think he would just say that he is not one of the politically correct people who say you have to be politically correct.
Mm-hmm. And he prides himself on being politically incorrect. So what do you guys think about his choice for Vice President Mike Pence? Good choice or not?
Well, I think Pence hit it right on the head last night in his speech, you know, when he started enumerate the characteristics of Mr. Trump. And then Governor Pence said, well, I think he selected me because he wanted balance.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So that's what I was thinking when I heard that Mr. Trump had selected Mr. Pence. I said, okay, he wants some balance. Mr. Pence is a solid conservative. He knows government, which I'm not convinced that Mr. Trump does. So I think he wants some balance there.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
All right, I want you to put on your ESP caps on right now, and I want you to envision the United States with Donald Trump as president.
Wow,
what will the country look like? What will his presidency do to our international relations, and what will the country look like as, with Donald Trump as president?
Well, you, Carol, Professor Pretlow, you want to take that?
Well, you know, I'm less. This is a hard question because, actually, it will depend on Congress and the Senate. All these things he says, oh, I'll do this. He's got to go through the House and the Senate. So, I'm not as nervous about that because I think people who are thinking more clearly and more constructively will have the final say. Now, sure, he'll be the face of the country in some circumstances, but it's not a touchdown for him just because he becomes president. So That's how I feel it.
Well, when he becomes president, first of all, globally, he's going to find that other heads of state are just as confident in their abilities as he is in his. So he's going to find that he is not the only person on the train. Then secondly, it's to the United States. As Professor Pretlow pointed out, he's going to fall into that category that Dwight Eisenhower fell in when he became president. And he said something to the extent, and I'll paraphrase it, that when he was a general in the Army, he said, do this, do that, and it got done. And then when he became president, he said, do this, do that, and not a he said another word, but not a darn thing happened. So I think Mr. Trump is going to find out that the reach of his power is not as extensive as he perhaps feels that it is now. Of course, the United States is a world superpower. He may be correct that we need to rebuild our military. Some people will agree with him on that and some won't. I personally think that we have gotten our military capability a little bit below that which it should be. So I think he's going to push for some of those kinds of things. But he's not going to be able to bully Congress, other world leaders, like he bullied those 16 persons running for the nomination of the Republican Party. I really think he bullied them. I was absolutely amazed that Governor Christie was pushed around by Mr. Trump the way he was pushed around. Because, you know, Governor Christie was supposed to be the bully. He was known as the bully. If you would ask him a question at his press conferences in New Jersey or what have you, he'd cut you right down to your knees. Mr. Trump walked all over him.
Yeah, but I think that was because Christie wanted to be vice president, so he was willing to kiss feet and look adoringly at.
And now I think he's upset now because he didn't get selected.
Foreign. The looks I saw were the looks of a deer in headlights.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He wasn't as bombastic as he had been as governor, because he was somebody else who was more bombastic and more in charge than he was, and he wanted something from him.
Now, this is going to be the contrast. We will see what the Democrats do next week, how much of a line the Bernie Sanders followers will toe. You know, they have a pretty strong pattern now of disrupting stuff at their meeting sites and what have you. So Bernie Sanders followers may make the Republicans look very tame and docile.
That's true.
We don't know. We'll know next week, however.
All right, listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion, if you've got a question or you just want to listen in, call us at 1-347-850-8515. That number again, 1-347-850-8515. All right, let's talk about the Democratic side here. What are the challenges and/or baggage will Hillary Clinton face over the next few months before the November election? Professor Barnes?
I think the challenge to Secretary Clinton will be keeping her base from disintegrating. She is going to have to go a bit more to the left than she really wants to be, because she needs those Bernie Sanders voters. She needs to be able to keep the millennials interested in her campaign, and a lot of those were the Sanders people. She needs also to be able to be not pulled too far to the left, because she is going to have to try to win over some of those independents who tend to be moderates. So she has a very it's a very long, tight rope to walk in order to keep her coalition together enough to win this election. And see, I think the thing that should strike the fear in the hearts of, in the minds of Democrats, is that no one thought Mr. Trump would get this far. The Republicans didn't. The Democrats didn't.
That's true.
The independents didn't. So we have to see how much of a so-called rogue election will this be. How many people will break with their traditional voting alliances, and if so, where will they go? So I think
that's a
challenge for Mrs. Clinton.
Well, I don't think there's too much for me to add. I agree to that. I think that Hillary has a lot on her plate to consider. And one of the things, although I have disagreed with some people about this, is the likability factor. Because I'm not looking to like these people. I'm looking at what you can do and how is it going to be done. But unfortunately, he does not come across, and now don't get me wrong, she's brilliant. She's very articulate. Well, her background is exceptional. But in terms of capturing the attention of, she's no Bill. She's just not that. So I think she's going to have to balance with someone who has more of a person-to-person appeal. I went to one of her rallies, and I stood there and said, wow, I can't believe this. I mean, she was there, but you didn't get the feeling that she was really a part of it. It was almost like mentally she was somewhere else and she was going through the motions.
That's interesting. I've never heard anybody say that about her.
Well, she took pictures and she did. Now, on the other hand, when Bill was ready, I went, when he came to Norfolk, I went, and he shook hands and he talked to everybody like, oh, I've known you for years. Oh, girl, what's happening? Oh, I like this. He really had the knack. I was like, he's talking to each of these people just like he knows them personally. And five minutes later, he probably wouldn't have recognized it. But he had that. Now, some people have it and some people don't. And I don't think she has that. So we have to look to her for other skills. And I think if the campaign progresses, we'll see those come out.
And she definitely has very high negatives. But I think one of the things that also that she's going to have to deal with, and this is just a gender bias, some people don't see a female in the White House, not as president. And these are people who can be very open-minded about other things. But it sort of takes me back to discussions that we've had in our church on several occasions about having a female minister. Some people are just not comfortable with that. And they are not bigoted individuals, at least they say they aren't. And the lines don't break along gender lines exclusively. You have females who are not ready to accept a female in the White House as president. So and it has nothing to do with competency. It has nothing to do with brilliance. It's just a mindset that the role of the presidency is a male role. We haven't come nearly as far as the Brits have come with Margaret Thatcher and now Prime Minister May. We haven't come as far as the Germans have come with Angela Merkel and what have you. So this will be very interesting to see how this plays out. This is why I don't think Elizabeth Warren is going to be her VP pick. I don't think she's going to conclude that the voting public will go for a female-headed ticket for
vice president. Could you imagine those two brains together in the White House? They're both brilliant women, though. I mean, that's...
They are.
Oh, man.
Oh, exceptional. But can you hear rural America?
Yep, I can.
Urban America, suburban America, talking about two women up there running the White House.
Oh, yeah, I can. Can
you hear
the boss? Yes, I can. Okay, so let me ask you this question. President Bill Clinton, positive or negative in the campaign?
Both.
Either one.
Positive for the very reasons that Professor Pretlow mentioned earlier. He's charismatic. He's an excellent campaigner. But also, he will do behave... He will do things that, if he thought about it, he wouldn't do again, such as that tarmac meeting that he had with the Attorney General.
Yeah.
on and knowing that the Justice Department was looking at the email situation for Mrs. Clinton. So he can be a positive and a negative, but overall I think he's mostly positive.
Professor Petlow?
Yeah, I agree. I'm kind of nervous about him because he's kind of a loose cannon sometimes, but at least he has played the game before, and if she is open to his suggestions and recommendations, I think he could be an asset.
Okay. What do you all think about, from your observations and your research, who should Secretary Clinton choose as a running mate? It's just your opinion there.
Mm-hmm. Well, my choice has already been knocked out of the park, and that's Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren?
Yeah. In fact, I'd rather have her running as president. But, okay. But I agree with Dr. Barnes that I don't think two women running is going to that would probably not be accepted. So,
you haven't thought of anybody else?
I haven't really, no.
Well,
what about you, Dr. Barnes?
Let me get back to Professor Petlow, please. Do you think there's any way that we could package Warren and Clinton that would be acceptable to the voting public? In other words, to pull together a winning coalition?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I really, it's really difficult. No, it might be with some real thought it could be done, because I looked at Warren doing a presentation. I guess it was early in the year, and she was very good. She mixes humor with, and you don't get the feeling that she's reading from a teleprompter either. Yes, you knew she had a guidelines and all and points that she wanted to make, but she was relaxed. She was humorous. She got her point across. So it could be, but I'm not so sure.
Now, my pick, and it's probably a long shot, I like Mr. Castro, Secretary of Housing. I think he's young, gifted, and has much to contribute. I think he will bring a perspective to the campaign that millennials could latch on to. But yet, on the same hand, I think he would be acceptable to a lot of independents.
Okay. Well, what about Cory Booker? Somebody mentioned him to me, too, yesterday. And was saying,
Well, now, this is my thought about Booker. He has the same baggage that Elizabeth Warren has. But hers is gender and his is ethnicity. Mm-hmm. I think Booker is African American, and Clinton is the female, and I don't think that package is going to float. Female head, African American VP, just like I don't think the package of Caucasian female package will float. I think that Booker is gifted. He's young. He has a lot to contribute, but I don't think that would put together a winning coalition. See, because Clinton basically, even though she should not make any assumptions about this, she basically, unless she does something incredibly stupid, she has the African American vote for the most part.
That's true.
So,
mm-hmm.
So the question becomes, what would Mr. Booker add to it? You know, isn't he New Jersey?
Yeah. Yeah,
So geographically, what would he add to it? And some people might say the same thing about my preference, Mr. Castro, that she already has the Hispanic vote, which I wouldn't say that. Well, you shouldn't assume that you have any vote, but they do try to play to their vote base. But I will tell you who is a really genuinely nice, talented person who is being considered, and that is our own Virginian, Governor Kaine, Senator Kaine.
Yes. I was going to ask y'all about Senator Kaine. Okay, yeah.
With Tim Kaine? Genuinely a thoughtful, caring, smart person. Plus, he knows politics.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. And I'll go ahead with my next question.
Or a more decent person.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he's very approachable. I mean, I've been at two events where, there's some situations where you say, oh, my, let me stand back. But he's very approachable, not quite as relaxed as Bill, but he's, even the clips last night that I was looking at him, I said, that might be a match there.
But the problem with Kaine is he's not exciting.
Well, that's true.
And
you say he's not.
Of reality entertainment, you got to have a hook to capture the attention of a considerable portion of the voting public. So if you're going to try to arouse them with a speech or what have you, now if you want some issues addressed and some rational thought, a clear deliberation, Senator Kaine is your person.
All right, I'm going to ask you again. This is if you put that precognitive vision on again. What will a Hillary Clinton presidency look like? What will be the impact on the nation and international relations?
Well, what I would say, Ms. Hargett, is that is going to depend upon what the down ballot elections are like. The president can just do so much. So who's going to carry the Senate? Who's going to carry the House? And where will these strategic losses and wins be? How much partisan divide will continue in the House and the Senate? See, the House and the Senate can keep a presidential administration locked up, can keep them from actually doing anything.
That is definitely true.
So I would say that it depends on how these down-ballot elections go.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Petlow?
Well, I agree totally. I don't think there's anything I could add to that. I think that we as Americans get very caught up in presidential elections, and I think we should be. But on the other hand, I've talked to whole groups of people who kind of don't even really think about congressional elections. And when I say, in fact, I was reading, I forgot the name of the young lady. She's an actress, a young black woman who's written this book about politics and how she first supported Obama, but now he hadn't done anything. And I was like, are you kidding me? Have you looked at Congress and what he has to deal with? But I think the public at large gets caught up in the media feed of the presidency, and they forget that down ballot, They forget that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you ladies have just been.
One hint about what's going on is how the election went in Virginia between Randy Forbes and Scott Taylor. The second district? And most people thought that Forbes was a shoe-in, given the baggage that Scott Taylor had. But what happened?
Yep, Forbes, Scott won.
Yeah.
Scott won. We did not expect that. You got that right. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. All right, ladies, I know y'all are busy, and I really appreciate this conversation. You've been open. You've been honest. You've given us your opinions and your thoughts and your analysis. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Petlow and Dr. Barnes,
for
taking time
so
to join us today.
Thank you.
All righty. For more information about all things Spartan Nation, visit nsu.edu. Spartan Life Radio airs on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Listen to this broadcast or others on demand at blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life. I'm Sharon Hoggart. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Spartan Life Radio. Tune in bi-weekly on Thursday afternoons for another new episode of Spartan Life. For more information on Norfolk State University, visit nsu.edu or check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and Flickr.